Hello, everybody, and welcome to the American Shoreline Podcast. This is Peter Rubella, co-host of the show.
And this is Tyler Buckingham, the other co-host.
Tyler, you know, every year NOAA keeps track of disaster events and the cost of disasters. They issued a report this year documenting the $23 billion disasters that have occurred in the United States in 2023 so far. And the Pew Charitable Trust, a great organization, took a closer look at what NOAA found in their analysis of billion-dollar disasters. And a couple things jumped out in the report that they have issued. From 1983, Tyler, to 2002, okay, 20-year period, basically the 80s to the early aughts, there were 96 billion-dollar disasters in the United States, cost $546 billion, right? Somewhere around half a trillion, basically. And then in the subsequent 20 years, 2003 up till 2022, like the most immediate 20 years, basically, $244 billion disasters in that 20-year period at a cost of $1.95 trillion. So almost $2 trillion. The number of billion-dollar disasters went up by 154%. The cost of these disasters went up 257%. Something's happened. It's a big deal. And we got a great show to talk about this topic. One of the lead analysts for the Pew Charitable Trust on this topic, Tyler, is going to join us today on the American Shoreline Podcast.
I can't wait to get into it, and Peter, to have you introduce our guest. And I just have to say that this is an interesting analysis. I'm really looking forward to diving in on this. But ladies and gentlemen, if you're paying attention, 257% increase in the costs over this most recent 20-year period. That is an immense increase. Do you think we've had a 257% increase in like policy reform? I don't know. I don't think so.
Good question.
So, you know, it's needless to say we are bending what the policies were originally intended to be, and there seems to be a bit of a vacuum there. I'm excited to forecast forward a little bit on that. But Peter, let's introduce the guest.
Joining us today on the American Shoreline Podcast is Matthew Sanders. He is a senior officer on resilience for the Pew Charitable Trust from Washington, D.C., joining us today. But Matthew is a Gulf Coaster, a New Orleanian, and spent some time down in Louisiana doing some great work on resilience, including running the L.A. Safe program, which I hope we'll hear a little bit more about, and the relocation of Isle de Jean-Charles, which was very well known in the coastal community. We've got a great guest.
Let's dive into it, but first, a word from our sponsors.
Support for the American Shoreline Podcast Network and Coastal News Today comes from Geodynamics, an NV5 company. Geodynamics' team of specialists provide accurate surveys of complex coastal environments around the world using the latest technology in marine geology, coastal science, and remote sensing. With customized vessels and sensor configurations, Geodynamics delivers meticulous data products to answer their clients' toughest questions. Visit nv5geospatial.com or geodynamicsgroup.com to learn more about Geodynamics and their solutions that improve lives. And from the Coastal Zone Foundation. The Certified Coastal Practitioner Program from the Coastal Zone Foundation offers courses covering 11 different subject areas, including coastal engineering, ecology, geology, project management, and more. The CCP program emphasizes a multidisciplinary approach to coastal zone management, setting you apart from the competition and demonstrating your commitment to best practices and a code of ethics in your field. With modules available online or as live short courses, the CCP program is accessible to coastal professionals at all stages of their careers. Learn more at coastalzonefoundation.org. And don't forget, subscribe to the CNT Daily Blast newsletter for the latest news and updates from around the American shoreline. Want to support our work? Learn more about sponsorship packages at coastalnewstoday.com/advertising.
Well, Matthew, thank you very much for joining us on the American Shoreline podcast. We sure appreciate your time.
Well, it's good to be here. You all highlight a lot of really important topics on this podcast, so it's good to join you all today.
Always our pleasure to have people from the Pew Charitable Trust, such an expert organization. Matthew, if you wouldn't mind, would you give us an overview of the Pew's portfolio when it comes to coastal issues generally, or particularly on disaster planning and resilience? What are you guys up to?
We actually just went through a visioning process and put a lot of thought into that and what that's going to look like moving forward. But broadly speaking, we've identified these two major issues that are the primary drivers of environmental risk moving forward. One of which is climate change. The other of which is biodiversity loss. And those two things are interrelated, right? And so when we think about the consequences of climate impacts and how that changes habitats and where terrestrial and aquatic species move, migrate, how they live, how that intersects with where and how we live and develop as people, we really see that as the kind of the issue of our time to engage on, at least from an environmental perspective. So that's broadly what we're working on. The line of work that I personally lead is more oriented specifically around how states and to a certain extent the federal government can engage in understanding current conditions, future conditions, and really aligning themselves from a governance perspective, a policy perspective, to develop good plans that really help us understand what the issues are going to be and how we begin to reduce risk over time.
Awesome. And I just want to echo what Peter said. I've just been blown away by the humans that work at Pew. It's just an awesome set of really smart, thought-leading people, which is why I'm excited to dive in, because what launched our inquiry into having you on the show, Matthew, was a post that you wrote. What's driving the boom in billion-dollar disasters? A lot. Could you talk about what led you to writing this, like starting at the very beginning?
Sure. So, we sort of talk anecdotally a lot about the idea that, we're experiencing climate impacts today in the form of climate-related disasters. On a trend line, we're experiencing those types of events with an increasing frequency and severity compared to what we have in the past. And every once in a while, there are information sources that come out to begin to validate that notion from an anecdotal perspective, right? And, most recently, earlier in the week, we had the most recent IPCC report come out that documents this quite a bit. But we've been looking pretty closely at NOAA data of late, and particularly when we try to work with states to help them understand what they're experiencing within their own states and how they can react to it. We've got good scientific data at this point that NOAA compiles and archives that dates back to 1980 or so. And so we can sort of parse out on a state-by-state basis the number of events that have taken place, where they've occurred, to what degree we've been able to document damages. But at a macro scale, we thought it might be interesting to look at this notion of billion-dollar disasters. And so this is something that NOAA has compiled, and they've adjusted for inflation to document these really sort of ultra severe disasters that are taking place across the country. And one of the things we found looking from the 80s through present day, and we parsed this out into two 20-year segments, is that, there's a fairly precipitous increase in both the severity and the frequency of these disasters in aggregate, right? So we think it's a pretty interesting data set to look at that kind of validates the trend line that, I think most people would agree. Just from, sort of living life in the world today and turning on the news and seeing one disaster after another that is unfortunately impacting quality of life, devastating life and property across the country. So we wanted to begin to quantify that in a way that that really helps people understand that this isn't a near-term condition. I think you mentioned in the lead-in that, $23 billion disasters in 2023, actually in the month since this piece published, I think we're now up to 25. To really begin to put some statistics and some good quantified data behind what we're all experiencing, I think is really going to be important. you know, really as a from a policy perspective, but also a political perspective, right? I mean, this has to be a topic that the public engages on, and that policymakers are taking action on, both with real action that mandates, you know, folks within all levels of government have a good understanding of what's happening, but also driving resources toward the types of solutions that can begin to bend that trend line over time.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think the operating, not the assumption, but I think the specific point of the analysis that you've provided, and then I think Pew continues to encourage, is that if we understand the extent of this particular problem of massive disasters and the cost of these events, that we will make adjustments in policy or programs or perhaps in development patterns. And I think Tyler put it pretty well in his intro comments that you wonder if there's been a 257% increase in the cost of disasters, billion-dollar disasters, in these comparison of these two 20-year periods that you've made. Has there been a significant or significant change in our approach to the factors that drive these disasters? When you look around at Pew and you look around at what coastal states are doing, and we're kind of focusing on coastal, do you see significant progress in response to the information that you found?
So I'll answer that in a couple of different ways. I'll first say, yes, we are seeing significant progress. And I think, you know, if you start at the federal government and you look at the funding sources that were appropriated through the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act in 2021, and then the Inflation Reduction Act last year, you are seeing large pools of funding that are being dedicated to programs that are specifically designed to develop out new infrastructure that takes into account future climate impacts, but also you're seeing, I think, a trend toward investment in quote unquote resilience in a way that is unprecedented. I think when you then look down to the state level, you know, if you look at the turn of the century, I mean, the concept of a chief resilience officer, either at the local level or the state level, was unheard of. Now you have more than 15 states have sort of taken steps to either appoint an existing official or a standalone chief resilience officer. 20 states have codified resilience within their own policy regimes, seven of which have codified that definition within statute. You've seen movement toward states themselves investing in resilience activities. South Carolina actually just put in excess of $200 million from their state budget into their South Carolina Office of Resilience. So you are seeing progress, right? And that's a good thing. I think there's a heightened awareness that we have a problem. We have an issue that's getting worse over time. It needs to be somebody's job within government at all levels of government to really take this issue on specifically. So there's a lot of awareness. There's a lot of movement. There is policy development. There is funding. I think the other way to look at it, though, is it enough, right? And does it meet the moment of that increase that you alluded to on a time basis, right? So, you know, we think there's still a lot of work left to be done in that regard, you know, because it's a moving target, right? You know, as we are experiencing higher temperatures across the world, right? I mean, in July, we had the highest temperature day recorded on record. We're having more types of events. And I mean, this is outside of this country, but, you know, one of the things that's kept me up at night was Hurricane Otis that recently hit Mexico, right? And was sort of forecasted to be something of a minimal event, and then, you know, spun up into a Category 5 hurricane pretty quickly and devastated that area of Mexico. And so we've got higher temperatures, we've got higher ocean temperatures nearer to shore that's leading to tropical events that in the past may not have been as severe, quickly developing into more formed systems that are causing wider swaths of the destruction. So, yes, there is movement. It is significant, but it's really difficult to catch up to conditions that are degrading very quickly.
I'm just curious, Matthew, as we talk about kind of the conceptualization of climate change and how to respond to it and what even resilience means, in studying these trends, and specifically, you know, the dollar cost of a disaster event. Is there like a proportionate impact between the dollar amount and like the impact? Like, I'm thinking about the Maui fire that, like, I think just in my reading about that disaster was really changed things. And I know there are many other examples of disasters like that, but there are also quite a few examples. Peter, we run stories all the time on Coastal News Today about like a community will be like wiped off the map in a hurricane. And it's like no one remembers it. it's like washed from the memory almost intentionally. Oh, we just move forward. It's like that's the resilient model that's been adapted by that community. And what do you think moves the needle at the grassroots level? The expense or the trauma or both? What do you think?
Well, I mean, I think it's all the above. I mean, so when we talk about resilience, let's parse that out a little bit, right? And when, you know, individuals are incredibly resilient, right? An individual gets impacted by a disaster, maybe loses their home. You know, I've seen time and again, you mentioned earlier, I'm from Louisiana. I've been proximate to this type of these types of events my entire life. But people individually, you know, I think are very strong emotionally, physically, their ability to pick up the pieces and try to put their lives back together. But that's not, you know, so much the point insofar as I think oftentimes when someone's life is devastated by a disaster, they sort of carry with them the notion of, well, you know, I've lived in this location for some proportion of my life. I've never experienced anything like this before. This is an unprecedented event. And the likelihood that I'm going to experience something like this again is minimal. And so I'm going to try to pick up the pieces and move on with my life in a way that I've already been through this bad event. I'm not likely to have to deal with this again. Let me just figure out how to pick up the pieces and move on. So, you know, one of the things that we focus on is the idea that, you know, we all need a collective sense of information that suggests that, yeah, just because you've experienced something once and it's never happened before, you know, you're actually probably more likely to experience a comparable event again in the future that may or may not happen in your lifetime. And so if we can create as many good data sources that illustrate to the public that this is a problem that is getting worse over time, and we need to disabuse ourselves of the notion that just because we hadn't experienced it before, we won't experience it again. You know, we think that sort of is a catalyst for collective action. You know, one of the things that we talk about particularly as it pertains to flooding is, you know, you'll hear characterizations in the media of, well, you know, this was a 100-year flood or a 500-year flood or a 1,000-year flood. And, you know, you're seeing those sort of quote unquote 1,000-year floods happen more and more to where you have to start thinking to yourself, well, this is probably not actually a 1 in 1,000-year event, right? That is a statistical probability that is laid out because it's how we're able to measure these types of things. But if we're only looking at historical precedent, we're not accounting for the fact that, in fact, more of these events are happening with more frequency. And that's going to impact more people. And that's certainly a good reason to devote more thought and funding into a better understanding of this problem and ultimately, you know, a degree of activity that helps mitigate risk in time.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. In the article that was released, and we'll put it in the show description when this podcast comes out, you point out that part of the problem is that our prediction of disaster events is based on historic data and a backward look, essentially hindcast analysis of previous events, and that historical record is no longer valid, or at least is not historically not predictive of the future because things are changing. So, and you've also pointed out that the density of people in coastal counties in America continues to get bigger. Development continues to get more expensive. There are 128 million Americans, almost 40% of all of us in the United States, live in coastal shoreline counties, including me. I am now in Thurston County in Olympia, Washington, on Puget Sound. So more stuff, more events. And I got to say, Matthew, the thing that concerns me a little bit is there is just no indication in my, well, I shouldn't say, let's just, I mean, there was little indication that local communities are doing much to curb the development patterns in coastal America. And they're doing these, they're ignoring that signal at a time when we know and you know that there's going to be more events. So I don't know. Is it hopeless?
No, I don't think it's hopeless. But let me unpack a few of the things that you broached there, because that was a lot.
Okay.
So you talked about the problem of hindcasting, right? And you know the thing with using a historical precedent to try to understand what may or may not happen in the future is that it assumes a series of atmospheric constants that are no longer constant, right? And so if we go back to high school physics, right? Properties of matter, right? Can't be created nor destroyed. You know, that applies to the water cycle. And so if you think about the idea that we are experiencing warmer temperatures in more areas across the country, warmer air carries with it more moisture, right? That's part of the water cycle. And so if you're hearing in the news about a drought event in one place, likely you're going to hear about a flood somewhere else, right? Because that moisture went somewhere. And so that's one of the things that we're experiencing when we talk about these weather extremes, right? There are changes in the water cycle that are driving that aren't going to be predicted by historical data. So that's part of it. And I think if there's a broader awareness around the idea that we are experiencing more extremes over time, then we have to apply that to land use and development decisions. So you alluded to, and we mentioned this in the piece, there is a study that came out of the University of North Carolina that found that for every one home that is bought out in a coastal area, there are another 10 that are developed. Well, you know, I think part of that is predicated by a lack of awareness and a lack of good understanding of what's happening. I think, you know, most people aren't going to go build a home. Most people are not going to go move into a home that they think is going to be significantly prone to disaster risk, right? I mean, even if you're fully insured, right? Nobody wants to experience the heartache of losing everything they own, being displaced from their home, having to pick up the pieces, right? So I think to the degree to which we have a better understanding of what actually is prone to large-scale disaster risk will help us figure out development patterns that are maybe more appropriate accordingly.
I'm curious, just to follow that though, because one of the things that has occurred to me is that there is really no safe space. I mean, I'm certainly would say that like there's higher risk areas, but it just seems like our current setup, the way we live our lives in modern America anyway, is just really vulnerable to climate change. Even disasters that might not impact your direct community can reverberate through our lives, through fuel prices or, insurance rates or whatever. And it's just like, it just seems like there is no, and maybe because there is no solution, that people just say, well, screw it. I'm gonna live on the beach and watch the sunset.
Well, I mean, I think, right, so in this country, we have a cultural preference, and this manifests in policy in a lot of different ways toward personal property rights. And so, you know, there's this notion of, well, I own this piece of property. I want to be able to decide what I'm going to do with it. And if that means that I'm living somewhere that is disaster prone, so be it. And I think to a certain extent that will always be the case. We also have this historic development pattern by which we've built most of our larger scale sediments proximate to water for commerce and transportation reasons. And so we've got a lot of like historical development that has led us to this place where there are a lot of places that are prone to flooding and other disasters. And there's no quick fix to change that. But I do think in terms of new development, there is an opportunity to be a little more intentional. So one of the things that we talk about in the resilience policy space is the basic idea of disclosure, right? And so, you know, when you transact in real estate, the historical experience of that piece of property paired with some articulation of a future projection of risk, then at least you're better informed to make better decisions. So I think that's a starting place. You know, a lot of work has to be done in that regard. There's a lot of debate around, well, what are the best data sources? What are the best predictive models that would be best be used to inform land use and development decisions? And that all needs to be adjudicated. But I think it starts with good information.
I'm going to be skeptical here, Matthew. The proposition you're laying out is that better information results in better decisions, fundamentally. If people only understood the risk, they would act differently, is the proposition. I'm highly skeptical, and let me give you a couple of examples. We all, and you remember this because you were on the Gulf Coast when Hurricane Ike blasted into the Gulf Coast of Texas and wiped out Bolivar Peninsula, really down to the ground floor. I mean, there was just very, very few structures on the peninsula. Outcome, higher land post prices, redevelopment at greater density and greater value. Fort Myers, Florida right now, the post-Hurricane Ian experience in Fort Myers, Florida, I've been watching very closely. We post a lot of it on Coastal News Today. Completely devastated. And yet, the cost of beachfront property has exploded. There are major new developments and greater density anticipated, and lots of local elected officials are cheering about the taxes they're going to collect on that. And the third one is Mexico Beach and Hurricane Michael, another one of these rapidly developing Cat 5 storms that blasted into the Florida Panhandle. Again, back in your neck of the woods. And so when, you know, here's the deal. If you're in Fort Myers and you're wondering, gee, is there a risk of building in Fort Myers? Well, you're standing in the middle of the devastation. There isn't any more information you need that says this particular area is incredibly vulnerable to storm surge and disaster. And yet, you know, we don't need a model. Hell, they're standing in the middle of the devastated area. And yet it proceeds. So this is my pushback a little bit here is better information. There's no evidence, in my opinion, that better information leads to better development decisions on the American shoreline. I can't see it. What do you think?
Well, I think a couple of things there to unpack that. So one of the things that we've seen as a precedent is every time there's a major disaster event, it is quickly followed by large scale subsidy to redevelop in those same places. Right. And so that subsidy comes in the form of an array of federal programs, including proceeds from the National Flood Insurance Program through, you know, FEMA's IAPA programs. In some cases, there will be appropriations of long-term disaster recovery funding through the Community Development Block Grant Program. So you have large-scale federal subsidy, and that's often paired with large-scale private subsidy that is ultimately paid out through insurance proceeds. Now, a lot of that subsidy is designed in such a way that it incentivizes redevelopment in place, right? So that's a current condition. I think that condition is changing, and I think that condition is gonna change more over time. And so one of the things that you talk about specifically with insurance, right? You're seeing indicators, right? When State Farm pulls out of California, for instance, when a number of insurers pull out of Louisiana, when the insurance marketplace begins to become a little more difficult to navigate in a place like Florida. That's where I think the market begins to change in a way that if you're operating on the assumption that every time there's a large scale disaster, that there will be large scales of public and private subsidy to follow to incentivize redevelopment in place, I don't think that's going to continue at the degree that it has in the past into the future.
I'm encouraged by that. I think you might be right there. But the person who laid it out best for me about the structural incentives toward redevelopment was Gilbert Gall in the book, The Geography of Risk. I suspect you have come across Gilbert Gall.
Yeah, great book.
And his work that says, basically, we've built a financial structure that makes all of this keep happening. And the fundamental structure has not been significantly modified. Now, I think the point you're making about the insurance industry and the pullout of the industry, both in California, Louisiana, Florida, that's been well documented in Coastal News Today, lots of good studies on it. What we're seeing, though, Matthew, in response to that reduction in the availability or cost of private insurance is public insurance pools being developed in Florida. I think it's called Citizens Insurance. And in Louisiana, there are comparable programs, and there are in Texas as well, where the power of these of these development communities and the homeowners and, you know, they're super powerful politically. When the insurance industry starts to get shaky, or the cost of the coverage starts to go up, which is it massively has, the political system provides an antidote for that. I mean, again, I'm basically what I'm saying is PU needs to go further. It's not just about information availability and the understanding of risk. There are financial infrastructure here that does this, and I think that's got to be dealt with.
Well, I think you're right. So let's unpack that just for a moment. So, you know, you talk about Louisiana Citizens, you talk about Florida Citizens. Those are the insurers of last resort in each of those two states. But there's some important distinctions between those two examples, right? So if you look at Louisiana, they just created basically an insurance subsidy pool with state budget resources. But what that does is it attempts to incentivize more private insurers to re-enter the Louisiana marketplace, because essentially they're trying to get people off of Louisiana Citizens as the insurer of last resort. And so what they're trying to do is actually reduce the liability associated to Louisiana Citizens from its current state, right? Which is a little different than what we're doing in Florida. But I bring that up because both of those examples are signals from those states in particular that there's an awareness of, at some point, there are going to be fiscal consequences to this changing landscape, right? And they want to be diversified in that fiscal risk over time. And so part of the information that I'm talking about is specifically from a fiscal perspective, what are the benefits of taking action today compared to waiting down the line and having to take action whenever there is an event, either through insurance proceeds or through redevelopment activities? There's a fiscal implication to both of those things, right? And so part of the information is, well, if we make better decisions today, do we save money? Do we experience additional co-benefits? If we don't spend today to mitigate risk or otherwise change how we react to these problems and better understand these problems, is there a bigger price tag down the line? And I think the answer to that question is yes. So that's part of the information argument that we're making. There's a price tag associated with more disaster events that are more severe in nature. Who ultimately pays the price, and how does that ultimately manifest itself into a total price tag to the taxpayer?
Matthew, man, woo, this is good. This is good stuff. You know what? You have,
yeah.
It just goes without saying. It's clear, but man, you've really put some thought into this. And I appreciate it. I really do, because Peter, you and I think about this stuff all the time, and what's driving the decisions, and you know what's happening. Peter, you referenced how the public, the politicians have been unable to change the structural incentives to rebuild, to hold on to this tax base. And it just seems like it's impossible to do a managed retreat, any sort of major buyout, or like, hey, we're no longer going to be active in this area. We just don't have it in our playbook. It's not, you know what? I would call that a social technology. It is a social technology we have not figured out yet. We talk about it.
I like that.
We talk about it, but we just don't do it. Anyway, Matthew. Let's talk about technology. Over this 40-year period that you studied, technology has changed a lot. Our knowledge of the planet has grown, I would argue, exponentially. And I imagine that over the next 20 years, it will continue to do that. Do you foresee a role for technology being able to help manage future disaster impacts?
Well, yeah. So I'll just give you an example. One of the things that NOAA is working on right now, and for the first time, there's a thing called Atlas, right? And they're working on the 15th version of that, thus the term Atlas 15, Well, basically what that does is it develops a precipitation model, and it's IDF curves, right? So intensity, duration, and frequency of precipitation. For the first 14 versions of that model, that had always relied on historical data. Moving forward with Atlas 15, for the first time, they're beginning to project out what a future IDF curve should look at based on changing atmospheric conditions. And so I think the extent to which we're able to model changes in climate, changes in atmosphere, how that ultimately passes down in the form of larger scale precipitation and other types of disaster events, I think, again, adds to the body of knowledge that we have to work with that can then be distilled down into policies, development decisions, land use decisions, and the like. So, you know, I mean, there's advancements all the time. There's actually a notion in a number of states about there's something called a MESANET system, in which you know, a lot of states across the country have networks of atmospheric modeling stations that can help inform early warning systems. Right now, I believe there are 36 states that participate in that program, and so there's a movement to try to fill in the gaps of the states that are not currently participating. So I think the extent to which we're developing new technology, applying it on the ground, gathering as much data and information as possible, and then distilling it in such a way that the lay public understands and can be used to inform policy and those development decisions over time. I mean, that's constantly getting better. So that will continue to be the case. There is obviously a role for technology here. One of the other things that you've seen rise up just in the past few years are mechanisms by which people are crowdsourcing information around what they're seeing on the ground. So, there have been a few pilots in and around New Orleans that you may be aware of that, people are able to document where they're seeing streets begin to flood in a real time way so that they can inform their neighbors and the other people that may be impacted by, whatever event may be occurring. So the extent to which we can not only gather information, but exchange information very quickly in real time will obviously be beneficial to our, both developing a better understanding of what's happening, but being able to make quick decisions in real time to hopefully avoid, some of the destruction that we've seen.
I mean, look, I agree, right? I mean, better information, more real-time data on the risks and the circumstances that are occurring cannot be a bad thing. That's got to be a positive factor. So I grant you that. But we're talking about, and you mentioned this in the article, about land use and development patterns. And basically, the way I took the analysis is that you're calling for the states to exert greater control over development patterns and take into account the risks to persons, property, and the public purse. I mean, the reason why government entities should try to do this is because of the cost to the taxpayer. I have real doubts about, talk to me about land use development management from a state level perspective. Are there examples that you can cite that say, you know what, states can be more assertive and do some things to reduce the amount of development in high risk areas?
Sure. So a few things there. And when you talk about land use, and I'm an urban planner by trade, right? So this is my background.
Yep.
I think part of what you're alluding to is the notion that we have home rule states, we have Dillon's rule states. And, in both of those permutations, in most cases, states have pushed responsibility for land use and development decisions down to localities. And that's well and good. But there are a few things that I'll keep in mind. One, every state is a significant developer of real estate within the context of their own state. So in other words, a lot of development activity is publicly subsidized in a way that is either directly invested in through state budget coffers or at a minimum, at least regulated by state policies in the case of federal grants that come down and pass through state.
Very true.
So the extent to which a state itself can orient its own development activities in such a way that every state building, every state facility, every piece of state-owned infrastructure is both sited and designed in such a way that it accounts for all of this good information that we've been talking about. At least in that case, you have states that are setting precedent for the rest of the private development community to at least understand what the state is doing compared to what may be happening locally. I'll give you another example, and just an example of that effect, by the way. You know, I'm in a state like North Carolina. I just passed an executive order last year that requires the state itself to look at its development activities and develop a policy regime that takes into account future disaster risk. So that, I think, is one step. Another step is if you look at states like New Jersey, Washington State, for example, that have local planning requirements that actually require a locality on a regular basis to develop a comprehensive plan. In the case of New Jersey specifically, the law stipulates that those comprehensive plans take into account future impacts of climate change. There's at least a regime in place that requires a locality to think through what those consequences are going to look like, right? And at least signal through its comprehensive plan what development activity should look like in response to those anticipated impacts.
Okay. I like both of those examples. The state having an influence over what is going to be built by controlling state infrastructure spending and you know, where state buildings go, that kind of stuff. That makes a lot of sense to me. And I like the idea of the states playing a more active role because, and in part because I think the economic pressure of the decision to approve a particular development dissipates a little bit when you get away from the local city council or the local county government, where the connection between the elected officials and the developers can be very tight. So if you move up the chain a little bit, maybe there's a lesser influence on the economics. But, you know, one of the examples that's been bothering me, you mentioned North Carolina, and I'd love to get your comments on this, is the constant rebuilding of Highway 12 on the Outer Banks of North Carolina. That I'm sure you're familiar with this. On the Outer Banks right now in Rodanthe, there's currently a couple of houses being taken off the beach. You know, there's some retreat. It's not managed. This is the unmanaged retreat kind of thing where you just destroy them and take them down. But what do you say about something like State Highway 12, where there's real clear, again, no absence of information about the risk? It's fully understood. Whatever storm surge model you want to look at, whatever flood inundation model you want to look at, it's there. They got all the information they could possibly need about the risks there. And yet the state keeps pumping hundreds of millions of dollars into this damn road. I mean, this is where, as Tyler said, the social technology, we're not quite sure how to reconcile our interest in doing the right thing on risk versus the political pressure to keep putting more stuff in the way. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, yeah. I mean, you talked about this notion of managed retreat, right? And I think, you know, one of the things I would point out is to some degree, retreat is inevitable. It's kind of up to us whether or not it's ultimately managed or unmanaged. I mean, I think in the case of Highway 12 or any other sort of specific example in a specific place, I mean, there is still an element by which, you know, the people of North Carolina have to make that decision, right? And if there's a political will to keep rebuilding that road, I think it becomes really difficult to get in the middle of that because, you know, ultimately the people that live in that area are represented, you know, in their state house and ultimately in Washington, just like everybody else is. So, you know, I don't think there should necessarily be hard and fast rules around, well, you know, whether or not this highway or that highway or this installation, you know, should be redeveloped. I do think, though, that there's a need to have a better understanding and more forward-looking planning around what is that inflection point, right? So if we understand an area that is going to be prohibitively impacted by sea level rise and may not be habitable or may not even exist in some cases, you know, what is that point in time around which we need to begin to roll back development, we need to roll back existing infrastructure, we need to think about relocating homes. Those are all, I think, very hyper-local decisions to be made, but they're never going to happen if that forward-thinking conversation never happens, right? I know it's a very abstract answer, but...
No, I appreciate it because I think that there's like, oh man, I'm reminded of Thomas Jefferson's like letters about the heart and the mind and just how they're like, you know, they're just like separate, they're oil and water. They just, you know, want, you can furnish so much information, and if the heart doesn't want to hear it, it just won't hear it. And I do think that there's a cultural thing because I'm just trying to imagine that road example. Peter, like in a different place on the American shoreline, where maybe the attitude toward the toward what that is would be different. And I do think you might get different answers in different places. And I think it's cultural. I do think it's there's like a cultural thing. And it's a political thing, as Matthew suggests. I mean, I think in certain jurisdictions, the political will would be exactly the opposite, to get the hell out. Like, how dare you interfere with that dune system and build that road? But it's just not the case in that particular place.
Let me ask you a question. That's a great point. You know, I think it is kind of regional or site specific or state specific. But over in your neck of the woods on the California coast, the reconstruction of the famous Pacific Coast Highway, Highway 1, after the significant landslides that occurred, wiped out the road and the train that runs right along Southern California's shoreline. These are infrastructure decisions that sort of fit the argument that that Matthew's making, that if you understood this risk more clearly, you might do something different. But what's your comment on like the PCL and the reconstruction of that road, which is highly, highly vulnerable, clearly?
Yeah, Pacific Coast Highway, PCH.
PCH, sorry.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's not just the PCH is the famous one, and it's on the coast. But I'll tell you, our roads all over this state got washed out last winter. Like many, many roads got washed out. And the bill to fix them and repair them and keep them running is ridiculous. It is. You could run a country on our road bill in this state. And I think that this is probably contributing to this $1 billion disaster figure,
yeah.
Honestly. But I do believe, actually, Peter, in the case of the PCH example, there is certainly discussion to move the road further landward and away from that immediate coastal area. I don't know if they opted to do that or not, but you know, either way, very expensive. And a lot of these roads, I should also point out, are remote, and it's like a frickin' movement to do the job. I mean, these are incredible construction projects. But anyway, I guess my point is that I do think that there's a political difference between North Carolina and California with regard to coastal development and development generally, although it hasn't, you know, these are moving targets and they've changed over time. And if you went back to the post-World War II time, believe me, they would build a road anywhere in California. There was no environmental consideration, or maybe very little. I shouldn't say no. And I just think that the cultural thing is important. I do have a question here for Matthew, and we've been exploring Matthew on this podcast, particularly because of Peter's new residence in Puget Sound. We've been learning more about tribal traditions and tribal knowledge and how tribal leaders are playing a role in land management and also thinking about climate resilience. In your work studying these disasters, did you talk to any tribal leaders, or also just from like a freewheeling sense, do you foresee tribal knowledge working its way into our cultural fabric vis-a-vis resilience into the future, climate resilience?
Well, I think when you talk about stewardship of land and water, you know, we would be remiss not to learn everything we can about traditional techniques that have been tested over a long period of time, predating, you know, the version of the United States of America that we experience today. And so, you know, that's something that Pew's been very much involved in. That's something that a lot of NGOs throughout the environmental community have been involved in. There's this notion of traditional ecological knowledge that you're probably familiar with, TEK, that is a thing that we try to promote at Pew. But yeah, I mean, I think it sort of is part and parcel with the idea that, you know, this is an all hands on deck problem, not only in this country, but around the world, right? And so the extent to which we can galvanize as much collective knowledge and collective action toward a problem that is ultimately impacting all of us is extremely important. But the other thing that I would say is, you know, and with particular respect to indigenous communities, when we look at our historic land use and development patterns, we do find in most cases, most of our, you know, in most cases, we have socially vulnerable populations, people that have been historically marginalized, oftentimes living in the places that are most prone to current and future climate-related disaster risk. And so I think if we follow the development patterns and where we find risk most pronounced, we're naturally going to be working with people like tribal communities that have been, you know, in some cases pushed out to those margins.
That does make sense. Matthew, I mentioned it in your intro, but you were in Louisiana and did a couple of things down there that are quite notable in regard to resilience planning and execution. You led the LA SAFE, which stands for the Louisiana Strategic Adaptations for Future Environments Program, and the relocation of Isle de Jean Charles community in the Mississippi Delta, which is an indigenous community. Looking at Louisiana, since you have such deep familiarity there, and now at Pew, looking at resilience on a national scale, what can you tell us about Louisiana's approach? You know, particularly New Orleans, how New Orleans has been handled, Isle de Jean Charles and LA SAFE. What lessons do you take away from your experience in Louisiana that inform your work for Pew?
Well, I mean, as a theme of kind of what I've talked about through most of this podcast, the idea that better decisions come from better information, a lot of that is built on my experience in Louisiana. So if you talk about LA SAFE specifically, you know, we had, that was a, what we called a co-design project from a planning perspective that attempted to lay out from a risk perspective what a flood risk profile would look like 50 years into the future. And we wanted to get as much crowdsourced information as we could from people that were going to be most impacted by that changing landscape as to what the future of their communities should look like. And so we, you know, ultimately held, you know, an extensive network of community meetings that, you know, more than 4,000 individual people attended and provided input on. And, you know, what we saw time and again is that when we presented from a geographic point of view, what flood risk was likely to look like into the future, even using the state's modest examples that sort of entailed like a moderate degree of environmental change paired with you know, a lot of coastal restoration and protection activities funded through Louisiana's Coastal Master Plan, even under that scenario, understanding that we would lose more land than we can rebuild in Louisiana, and there would be a higher flood risk profile in a lot of different places along Louisiana's coast. With that information, we got a lot of really good input from the people living in those specific locales about the need to lower density in some of the places that would be most prohibitively impacted and begin building up some of the places that would naturally be a little higher, drier, and safer. And so, you know, a lot of my sort of philosophical leanings on this whole information topic are built on seeing it in action in a place like Louisiana. But Louisiana is one of the only places, by the way, that has actually put a lot of time and effort in developing out along a 50-year time horizon, you know, what that coastline is likely to look like, right?
Yep.
So I think from that perspective, that's a good example that I think other states should look at and potentially follow. But, you know, you talk about Isle de Jean Charles specifically, and that is it's a low-income, socially vulnerable community that there's a group of people that are predominantly indigenous that had been residing on the island for many generations and had been sort of pushed out to that island landscape by virtue of other development activities as metropolitan New Orleans and Southeast Louisiana were habitated and developed over time. And so, you know, that was a group of people that had been living proximate to water for a very long time, had understood the degree to which disasters were becoming more prevalent and more severe over time, and had decided for themselves that community's future would not likely be on that island. And so what we did was we worked with them to move to a new community location around Schriever, Louisiana, if you're familiar with that landscape. But just to, you know, sort of create a contrast, you know, where they were on the island was significantly below sea level. The average elevation of the new site that they moved to is right around 12 feet or so. So, I mean, you're talking about a stark contrast just in terms of elevation. And then, you know, the state of Louisiana also worked pretty extensively to build in factors relative to the design of that community from a structural design perspective to at least account for the future projection of risk that the state had in hand.
It's a great example, and one of the, one of the few examples of a relocation of a community. Do you remember the price tag on that thing, the relocation cost? It was more than $100 million, I thought.
No, well, so it's that was part of a grant that that I led and the state received as a result of the National Disaster Resilience Competition, and the resettlement project specifically was $48.3 million.
Okay. Well, this is the work of the good work that Pew is doing and others on resilience around the American shoreline. It's a huge issue, and as you mentioned, a massive new federal investment in resilience planning all around the country, hundreds of millions of dollars, billions actually going into this program area. And it's great to have you on, Matthew, to walk us through a little bit about the considerations that go into it. We want to thank you for coming on the show.
Well, it's been great to be here. And again, talking about, you know, information, right? It's important that people like you are around to disseminate good information to interested parties that listen to the podcast.
Yeah, thanks. We try. Ladies and gentlemen, it is Matthew Sanders. He is a senior resilience officer with the Pew Charitable Trust, joining us from Washington, D.C., one of the people trying to figure out one of the most complicated policy issues on the American shoreline. Matthew, thank you very much for your continued effort at Pew, and we look forward to talking to you guys down the road sometime.
Great. Looking forward to it.
This morning, found that I was confused.